Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
We also now have a post-industrial global modern world with all kinds of new problems that have nothing to do with an industrial economy, and to which the party's toolkits don't have anything to respond to. Because if you try to come up with, okay, what do we do with the rise of AI or the rise of China? All right, is the answer more New Deal programs? It doesn't make any sense. Is the answer fight big government? It doesn't make any sense. The two parties have toolkits that are built to dealing with industrial problems that don't have tools for the problems we now have. And that ultimately has led to stagnation, because we have two coalitions built around ideologies meant to solve problems that no longer exist. And we have new problems that need solutions that they don't have tools. And if they try to create tools, it means breaking orthodoxy. It means alienating their coalition. It means doing something brand new.
Today is a special episode on a couple of different levels. One, we are doing the extended Q&A that we long promised. We got a bunch of great questions across a variety of topics, so we wanted to take the chance to answer them for you all today. And then secondly, Sagar couldn't make the recording of this episode, but I am interviewing Frank DiStefano. You might not have heard of him, but he wrote a book about political realignments that actually came out a few months before the show actually started. So the book is called The Next Realignment, and it is absolutely fascinating. We've spent over 100 episodes talking about political realignments in politics, media, tech, business, but we've never actually sat down and articulated what realignments are, how they relate to U.S. history, and what they mean for this very specific moment that all of us as listeners, as hosts, as guests, understand we're in the middle of. So this is a great conversation. It goes a little longer than normal. We know people have been asking for that. So I'm really excited. Frank also has an amazing YouTube channel where he breaks down the themes of the book, talks about realignments after the Civil War, during Thomas Jefferson's presidency, during the New Deal, and the current moment. So it's just all this really great stuff. Definitely check it out. We'll have the links in the show notes. Let's get to the Q&A session.
Hey guys, love the show. Why do you guys go long for some guests and not for others? All right, Marshall, bring them in behind the curtain.
Yeah, so love this question because it gives us a chance to have us actually explain these things. A couple things. One, it's sort of flattering that people think we're in a position to get big guests and actually get them on a Zoom recording for 2 to 3 hours. It just doesn't happen. We've talked about this before, but Sagar and I obviously have day jobs, actually multiple day jobs in certain contexts. So we can't just record for that long. But the reality is, even if we could consistently do that, guests just probably wouldn't do it, because the reality here is we are a growing but mid-sized podcast, and people are incredibly busy, especially when we catch people during book tours. So for example, a lot of you loved our episode with Admiral Stavridis. That's one of the favorite ones that I've ever done. We originally had booked him for an hour, and then 20 minutes beforehand, we get a note from his publisher saying he has to actually cut 15 minutes early because, as he's released a new book, he had interview after interview after interview after interview. So this is the reality of doing podcasting during the Zoom age.
I'm glad you said that, Marshall. It's important for people to understand, like, look, I wish we had 3 hours only. This was all we did. And look, when you're Joe Rogan, people get on planes to come see you. They take the whole day off. Guess who's not Joe Rogan? The two of us. And like I said, I mean, I would love to sit here for an hour and a half, 2 hours or whatever with Admiral Stavridis, but it's just not going to happen. Most of the time, especially because Marshall and I have jobs, other calls and other stuff that we have to also schedule within the day, we're lucky to get an hour with somebody who's particularly busy, especially if they're on book tour. I want people to know this. Like, they stack it so that they do like 9 different interviews back to back to back to back to back. Having actually done one of these things, they're called a roadshow, it's incredibly difficult. It's very taxing. And it's very hard actually to even do an interview, to break somebody out of their standard script about books. So we do our absolute best here, at the realignment in order to shake that up. But it's just a little peek behind the curtain in terms of what does it take to actually book big name guests. Let me tell you, there are a lot of emails flying around, calendar invites, people are late, people's assistants forget to forward them. Sometimes you got to go through your book agent. Sometimes you got to go through some other guy. Twitter DMs seems to be the best way to book people, but then people forget to reply. You guys get the idea. It ain't so easy doing this job every day. Okay, what's the next one, Marshall?
Next question comes from Kate from the United Kingdom. Dear Marshall and Sagar, love the podcast. I've learned so much. Thank you. I said as much in the 5-star review I just submitted. Thanks for that, Kate. My question is about what drives you both into a career in politics and journalism. I'm a college student in the UK with a great interest in politics, but with more cynicism than I'd like about the future. I wonder if either of you have had many times where you felt totally dejected about the way politics is going and your ability to make a difference. What drives you both to keep working hard on what interests you and what you think matters? Thank you and all the best. Kate, smiley face.
That's a fantastic question, Kate, and actually comes at a very opportune time, which is I think Marshall and I have probably never hated politics more than right now, which is that we literally live in an age where I think everybody has lost their goddamn mind. I recently did a monologue on Rising in which I called it a clown show politics, and I think that that's exactly what we're living in. We have a conservative movement which is completely and totally obsessed with the culture war at the expense of everything else. We have like elite liberalism and Democrats, which are like still convinced that they're fighting fascism 2.0. And if you really want to discuss what the real problems that are facing this country are, it's not exactly like that's a great way to make a living. That being said, there are enough of you. And I think that that goes to your question, which is what makes you keep working every day? Messages from people like you. Messages that I get on Instagram or Twitter, YouTube, wherever, people who recognize me on the street and say, your podcast, your show, your appearance here helped me understand the way that the world works. And that means more to me than anything some politician or whatever ever would. And so, first of all, please keep it coming just because it means so much to me personally. I can't even really tell you or describe it. But more importantly, which is that there are some of you, enough of you out there in order to make this worth it. What do you think, Marshall?
This is the perfect episode to air this question during, because the whole point of the conversation I have with Frank is during these moments of political realignment, politics is almost always terrible in some way. He has this great line where he says there are good realignments and there are really bad realignments. A bad realignment was during the 1840s, when the big issues of Andrew Jackson's presidency, for example, the existence of the Bank of the United States, the debate about whether or not American democracy was going to be populist and include the people over elites, those issues were actually settled. The bigger issues were obviously the expansion of the country, the fight over slavery. And his point is that during that period, rather than focus on those forward-facing issues of slavery, you had slavery, expansion, et cetera. You had a political class that was hyper-focused on the issues of the past and didn't actually have an idea of how to articulate and engage with the front-facing issues. So we're in a moment that's like that. Obviously, the stakes aren't as high as the pre-Civil War era, but in instances where people can't confront all the challenges we're facing during the internet digital age in comparison to the things that were going on after the New Deal, it's going to be sucky. But the whole point of our conversation, what makes me optimistic, is the idea that a lot of our listenership, ourselves included, obviously, are young enough that we're going to be able to make it to the other side, to something that's going to be better, something that's going to be more interesting, and that's what's going to keep us going. We're definitely not here for the day-to-day palace intrigue stuff, which is just totally boring and inconsequential at this point.
It's really well said. Man, I can't wait to actually listen to this episode and hear what Frank had to say. Okay, next question. Hi, guys. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Do you think America's political infrastructure, for example, the Electoral College, gives conservatives or the GOP a bigger voice than they actually have? Could that also be contributing to the polarization of America, since a disciplined minority is capable of mounting a significant resistance, even though the majority of the country may want something else? What do you think, Marshall?
This is an interesting question because I would reframe it a tiny bit. So it's not that the Electoral College literally gives the GOP a broader advantage. I think what it does is it preferences or it creates a certain model of politics where portions of the country have more power than they naturally would given their numbers. So a good example of this would be rural voters who live in small states, such as Wyoming, which have the same representation in the Senate that California or New York or Texas, the other big states are. So right now in our current political moment, that means that these states, which tend to be Republican leaning, are advantaged. But the broader thing that's going on there is you want a, or at least the founders of the country wanted a country where there'd be a balancing of the big state, little state, urban, rural interests. So I think we should state the situation in that context, because that will give us a better ability to think through what we think is good about that system, what we think is bad about the system. Because as, for example, we talk about during the episode with Frank, if it's the 1890s, those rural interests are actually really divided from the urban ones, not just in the sense of culture war issues like we see today, but in the sense of, hey, silver, the devaluing of farms, the question of whether or not you're going to have these towns which had come up during the frontier era, were they going to be successful during the early 20th century, during the industrial age? That wasn't an issue which fit within our current Democratic-Republican context. And you saw Williams Jennings Bryan, who we get into during this episode, really rising and taking the Democratic Party in that more populist direction. So we're going to see this in different contexts.
I'm glad you put it that way, Marshall, because it's important to separate from what it's become and what the actual principle behind it is. And I'll probably get a lot of hate mail for this, but I actually think there's a lot to the Electoral College, which is that in a direct democracy, 51% take all, you're basically incentivizing in our current system, which is that you will have the coasts rule the rest of the country. And I just don't think that's right. There are all kinds of crazy compromises which have been forged in our history, in which actually civil rights and more are another good example, in which like water dam funding became something which became incredibly important in order to supply power to states which had disproportionate representation, to use your language, in the United States Senate simply because the Senate gives equal body to all the states. And that's not maybe not the best example, but really what I'm trying to get at is they were trying to balance urban and rural areas. It is a fundamental tension within our democracy. And I think that it's probably a good thing, and that that tension makes sure that we are not forgetting about the rest of the country. Can it be rebalanced? I don't know, given that you literally would have to rewrite the Constitution. And I think that there is a deep wisdom to this balancing of a system, despite how terrible and awful it can seem at times.
And this is just a great example of the complicated and really honestly shitty nature of American history, because if we're talking in the late 18th century, what we really mean when we say balancing urban and rural interests, we're basically saying slavery. So
yeah, you're right.
This is an issue which is going to be moral and immoral during different contexts. So it's important to acknowledge that. But at the same time, we also need to acknowledge the obvious fact that Democrats control the House, Senate, and the executive branch right now. So even in this system, which enables a Republican Party, which literally cannot win the popular vote in the majority of elections to win the presidency, you still have Democrats able to succeed. So that has to be kept in mind as well. Well, thank you, everyone. Love the questions. Send them in. Submit them on Apple Podcasts with a 5-star review. Email them to realignmentpod@gmail.com. Last but not least, be sure to check out Frank's book and his YouTube channel. We'll have included it in our show notes.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it. Let's get to it.
Frank DiStefano, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks a lot for having me.
This episode has been a long time coming. I actually told this to you before we started recording, but I purchased your book a month or two before we launched the show back in 2019. And unfortunately, I didn't read it, because when you launch a podcast, you very quickly get subsumed in books. But I actually regret genuinely so, waiting this long, because actually just reading through it has helped me better articulate and better encapsulate the moment, the ideas we're trying to really focus on here. So it's super awesome to have you and everything.
Yeah, I'm thrilled too. I'm a big fan of what you guys do. So yeah, let's talk about realignments.
So let's start with the personal real quick, which is what got you interested in this topic specifically in terms of your background, your political experiences recently, everything like that?
Yeah. It was really a question of the 2000, it really started with the 2008 campaign because, so I, you know, I had been a Hill staffer. I had worked on the Hill in the 90s. I had worked on, I was national political director for issues for Rudy's 2008 campaign, and then went over and helped out with McCain's campaign. And but I, there was kind of a couple of years between there where I was kind of not really working in politics, where, you know, I'd worked on the Hill, I went to law school, I was practicing law for a while, and then I went into the campaign. So and in between, I felt like something was wrong, right? On that campaign, on that. So this was already in 2008. I felt like something was happening in politics that was odd that I had to solve. And after that, I really got obsessed with this idea of, you know, something was breaking down in politics and that I didn't know what it was. And there was a little bit of personal, like I wanted to chart out what, you know, what I wanted to do. I'd always, you know, my original plan in life was, you know, I wanted to run for office and do that kind of thing. And I was trying to figure out where things were going. So I started getting interested in figuring it out. And so I just started, you know, looking into the books to figure it out. And what I realized is that, so you start reading and you start saying, okay, well, how does what happens, how does what's happening today compare to where we've been in the past? And every time you start doing it, you start peeling another onion layer out about things that you didn't know about. Because, you know, you get the sort of high school history version of mm-hmm. political history, but it leaves a ton out. But more than that, the real frustrating thing is so much of it is siloed, right? So like it, when we think about politics, like if you're like a participant in politics today, and say you're dealing with the Republican Party, well, you would know just naturally, you know, how many things are affecting what the Republicans are doing. Social history, religious history, right? You'd know that they're like, okay, well, the religious right, well, that was a, you know, that's a big movement. Where did the evangelical movement come from? You know that that evangelical thought is important to what's going on, right? But when you read political history, it doesn't do that. It's just polls and statistics and political leaders as if the entire, everything else going on in the country isn't going on. So then you start realizing that a lot of political history and political science is very siloed, where it doesn't engage with the economic history, with the history of ideas, about the social and moral history. So, you know, I start having to peel back further layers of the onion to piece together what was really going on to kind of build, and this is what I've been, some people have said that I've really liked about the book, is that it's sort of a unified theory of political parties, that you had to kind of construct a unified theory of all these different silos that don't talk to each other about, okay, realignment theory is something that's existed since the 1950s, though it kind of, it's been so long since a realignment, people have kind of, it's kind of fallen out of fashion because people keep waiting for the realignment and it hadn't happened. And, you know, now that it's here, all of a sudden people were interested again.
Sounds quasi-religious like, when you're describing it that way. Everyone's waiting for the realignment. It never comes.
I mean, there's a whole interesting history about this, about, you know, in the 60s and 70s in the Nixon campaign. And, you know, everybody in politics in that era from late 60s to the 80s was, you know, realignment theory was sort of on top and everybody was looking for everything to be a realignment. And Nixon shaped his 72 campaign. He had political scientists on. The whole thing was built around that he was going to lead the realignment. Like he was using realignment theory and political science, and that was his Law and Order campaign in 72 was all built around that. But what happened was, you know, people then got frustrated because it, when it didn't happen, and people thought, well, you know, and they moved on to other ideas. And now everybody's come back to it because it was like, it just took longer than everybody thought, right? And the thing about realignment, this is why I say the unified theory, is you know, there's not a lot about like how and why do they work, right? Mm-hmm. What are the ebbs and flows of politics that cause this cycle to happen? It's not just sort of, you know, voodoo magic that every so many years the parties collapse. There's a reason behind it, right? There's a process about why it is that we create parties the way we do, why it is that they decay, and why it is they fall apart. And once you understand that, you know, and how that meets with the story of America, then you start seeing the patterns and where we are now. And you're like, well, of course we're having one right now, because all the conditions that create a realignment have happened again. So, you know, you kind of need that unified theory of how all these things interact. And once you have it, you can see these patterns as they repeat again and again. And, you know, the situations and the issues are always different, but the broader idea is the same, which is, you know, political parties are ultimately about these great debates. They're how we channel our views on whatever is a big crisis issue at a time. And they divide us into two groups as we have this debate. And then we carry on that debate for decades and decades until eventually it gets resolved. And then when it gets resolved, we have to, you know, the parties start decaying. They don't immediately collapse. They, you know, careerism and inertia take over, and they start decaying, and nothing gets done, and the system gets corrupt again. You know, you start getting things. This is the era of good feelings, or the you know, the Gilded Age, or the 1840s, or the Roaring Twenties, and you know, politics stagnates, and nothing gets done, and everyone's getting frustrated, and there's a new crisis brewing, and then eventually the crisis comes and knocks the old system down, and then we got to build it again. And how do we do it? We build two parties around, you know, two new political coalitions, probably a better word than parties, around solving that new crisis.
Well, and that gets to something. And I like your nuance on new political coalitions and not political parties, because it gets to not an objection to the book or the framework, but a quibble, because it's not that political parties die, quote unquote. So for example, you talk to a Democrat, a hacky Democrat, maybe they'll say the Democratic Party is the oldest political party that's ever existed in the Western world. Because technically speaking, something approximating the Democratic Party has existed since roughly Andrew Jackson. You could push it, you could push it even back further, Jefferson, technically speaking, to Jefferson.
But I would say Jackson.
Jackson, Jefferson. Actually, that's the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. It used to be a thing.
Yeah.
The point is, it hasn't died. But the point you're making is that the coalitions that made up that thing are different. So it's like a record label, right? The record label company is still there, but the actual artists and the acts and the actual content is different every single time.
I like thinking about it too, like a sports franchise too, right? Like, okay, so like on paper, the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Dodgers today are the same team. But is it like really the same team? No, because it plays in a different place, a completely different roster of players, different sort of philosophy and coaches. There's an institution, but it's that institution has changed a bunch of times over history. You know, on paper, you treat it like the same team, but it's not really the same team. And the thing with, the names don't always change when the parties change. So by a party, you know, when we talk about party systems, that they say that we've had five party systems, five distinct party systems of two parties that had a unique coalition and a unique set of ideas. It stood for a unique thing, and it stayed that way for decades and decades, and then suddenly collapsed, and then you get two parties again with a different coalition of people and a different set of ideas, and it stands for something completely different. All right. So sometimes the names stay the same and sometimes they don't, depending on how that transition happens. So we've had a Democratic Party going back to Jackson, but we've had, you know, four different versions of a Democratic Party, and each version had a unique coalition of people, a unique ideology, a unique set of ideas that it cared about. And each era, each version, it stayed that way consistent over decades and decades until it came apart, and then we had a new version that was different. So, you know, when I say party, I mean sort of not the brand name. The brand name doesn't matter. That each party is unique in what it stands for. And on that way, you know, that's why we have five party systems, and five, they're really different parties because they stand for different things, whatever you call
it. Well, here's what's fascinating though. And we'll get to the history in a second. I got a couple more definitional questions, but sometimes the party label does matter. That's why it's fascinating, right? So, for example, you get into this Federalist, that becomes an epithet. Mm-hmm. So that actually was a party name, a party label, a sports franchise, pick your metaphor, that was actually so toxic that you actually can't rehabilitate it with new people. The Whigs, not toxic in the same way, but not sustainable. So it had to be dropped. So sometimes the labels do matter. I think what's unique about, I guess probably what you would say, our politics since the Civil War is that the labels themselves have stuck, and there hasn't been a totally cataclysmic event so discrediting in the manner that the War of 1812 was, and in the manner that the pre-Civil War eras for the Federalists and for the Whigs were today.
Yep. Yeah, and that's and then it's both the toxicness of the label and whether you get a figure who comes along to do a radical reform where they take over a party. Like, so, you know, this is the William Jennings Bryan example, which I, you know, I find probably the most fascinating of political history, what that guy pulled off, right? But, you know, what he had done, you know, there was a populist party, a third party that was sort of gaining steam across America, and it was winning governors and senators, and it was tapping into the new ideas that the American middle class, which at that time is family farmers.
So the 1890s, you know, the stuff, right? Just to set the timeline here.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking 1896, and it's a real parallel to where we are now because, you know, the big problem was industrialization. We have a new economic model, and it's killing the middle class, which is family farmers. And they're working hard and playing by the rules that they had always played by. And all of a sudden, the rules changed. And there's these millionaires getting made in new industries, and they're falling behind. And they're getting pretty angry about it. And the political parties have nothing to say about it because we're still stuck in the Civil War era parties. And this is the Gilded Age. And politics is basically still waged on fighting Romanism and rebellion and waving the bloody shirt. And, you know, it has nothing to do with the things people care about, which is, you know, how come my family farm that I've had for generations is going under as deflation is eating away my crops and the railroads are sticking it to me, and now I can't get to market without these new railroad companies as middlemen and all this. All right, so what does Bryan do? Well, he wins, you know, he's a 36-year-old kid. He's a two-term congressman, and he's out of office. He runs for Senate and loses. So he's got no office. He's 36, and he walks in the Democratic National Convention, and he gives that Cross of Gold speech, which is this big populist speech that energizes everybody. And he takes, and it so energizes everybody that they give him the nomination for president. And then he takes the entire Democratic Party agenda, its ideology and what it stands for, its elites, throws them away and basically merges it with the populist party and takes all the populist ideas and imports it into the Democratic Party. All right, so the Democratic Party brand survives. Like, and the way that story is told is, well, the Democratic Party co-opted the populists. But, you know, I don't see it like that. I see it as a third party takeover, right? That's a new party. Basically, he threw out the guts of the Democratic Party and he imported the guts of the third party populist party and then reinvented it, all right?
Because the key thing to add to your framework in terms of the history, though, because in the book, this is still fresh in my mind, your point is it's not just that when you talk about guts, you're talking about, I mean, staff isn't quite the equivalent because that's more of like a 20, but the apparatus is different. The figures are different. It's important to note that William Jennings Bryan captures the nomination three times. He goes on to be Secretary of State. So it's not as if, because this is a good point you're making, because if the Democratic Party captured the populists, then you would just see the same old people using new language. But that isn't what happens here.
No, right. That's exactly right. And, you know, William Jennings Bryan comes from, like I said, a 36-year-old nobody to, right, he runs, he wins the nomination three times. He basically dominates the party for the whole era. And the only, you know, Democrat who then wins in his time is Wilson, who, and he was kingmaker for Wilson. Wilson only got the nomination because Bryan gave it to him. Bryan basically picked him and then became his Secretary of State. So, you know, that whole era of the Democratic Party is the Bryan era. And so, that's right. And, you know, there was a third party movement when Bryan ran in 1896. The Democratic elite tried to split off. I think it was the National Democratic Party or something like that. And they lost. You know, they basically got pushed out of the party. So it was a complete transition into a new institution, essentially, using the old name.
What's so fascinating about this, this is a quick tangent, but I'm just thinking about this in a historical context. And can you think of a single quote unquote losing figure who is more just present in most people's, you paid attention during junior year of high school history, President William Jennings Bryan, right? So because he loses pretty consistently if you actually think about it, right? So he loses all three nominations. He loses when he's Secretary of State because America enters into World War One, and then he wins the Scopes Monkey trial. But from the perspective of history, he loses. It's actually funny. In many ways, he's seen as the quote unquote villain in that context. But if anything, a lot of his opposition to evolution was very admirable. So it was opposition to the eugenicist version of evolution. Mm-hmm. It was very much his, hey, I'm against the Gilded Age. A lot of Gilded Age people have like this really evil, bastardized version of evolutionary theory. So it's just, let's pour one out for William Jennings Bryan for a second.
Let me tell you, we talk about YouTube videos. That's been like, I think that's the most popular video is William Jennings Bryan. Because he's fascinating. He's the most the fact that we don't talk about him more too is fascinating to me. Because again, you know, that whole race in 1896. One, the fact that he, let's say, I keep fixating on 36 because I'm getting old. So now I look at that and I just can't believe that. I mean, it's basically like if AOC came and ran for the presidency instead and won the nomination. You know, he would have won. He got real close
after losing her primary for Chuck Schumer, basically.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like she. Yeah, it'd be like if she ran against Chuck Schumer, lost, and then ran for president and got the nomination, and then dominated the party for 30 years. It's really staggering politically what he did, and you know, and he's huge figure in history. That he's. In pop culture, he becomes a millionaire just as a speaker and writer. He's, you know, when he goes to Europe, they follow him around like he's the queen, you know, writing wherever he goes. You know, he dominated that era. And so it's like when you said who, it's like him and Henry Clay are the two who come to mind, right? Mm-hmm. Henry Clay's the other one who, just because he never won the presidency, people kind of forgot about him. And yet he dominated his era. Him and Jackson in the way that Bryan dominated his era too. Those are the two sort of giants of American history that I feel like don't get enough credit for the just pure, presence that they had over the system.
Yeah, I mean, just to put a pin in this super tangent, but I love it because it's exciting and it's, to your point, the YouTube algorithm prefers it. So we're just going to lean into that. It stinks for him that him being such a big personality in American history runs into probably the biggest personality in American history, which is Theodore Roosevelt. So that's really, if you really just think about how, and we'll probably get into this during the history, but it's just very interesting that you have this period at the end of the 19th century, where you had all these incredible figures just combined into a very specific moment. So two quick
after last a period of stagnation, right?
Exactly.
After, between Reconstruction and 1896, it's probably what there was a famous the quote from who was it, Henry Adams or whatever, about the entire 20-year period is just like I can't remember. Basically, it was just a corrupt waste. Nothing happened.
Yeah,
it was just it was probably the worst period in all of American history. And then to go from that to the populist and progressive era, where you get Roosevelt and Bryan and just all of the intellectual and social movements and America becoming a great power, America emerging as a second rate power, that's the era that America becomes, rich and prosperous, inventing the telephone and the airplane and all these inventions, and coming to dominate the world. It's really just a fascinating period of time.
So for anyone who hasn't been paying attention, can you just quickly define what a political realignment actually is?
Sure. All right. So so people think political parties change gradually over time, right? And we're discussing, they don't. They stay the same for long periods of time, basically ideologically unchanged. And then in a period of about a decade, they collapse and get completely recreated with a new ideological debate. And that transition is a realignment. So a realignment is not about one demographic voting group going to one party to another. And that's what always frustrates me to death.
So to put a pin on this real quick, just to make sure this is clear, because I'm bringing in the context of our episodes we've done.
Yeah.
Joe Biden and the Democratic Party in 2020 overperforming with upper middle class suburbanites who used to be Eisenhower Republicans. That is not a realignment.
Correct. That could be the material to create a realignment, right? Mm-hmm. So, because the thing with what Joe Biden did is he didn't ideologically change anything. He basically ran on the 20th century Democratic agenda, right? He ran as the same sort of agenda and the same ideological coalition and the same ideological ideas that have been Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter or John Kennedy. Like, it's the same New Deal liberalism, right? New Deal liberalism was the idea that came out of the New Deal, this idea that we could merge populism and progressivism into an new ideology that had never existed, to say we could experts could use social science and policy and planning to benefit working people, the marginalized, and the least well off. That's how I always put New Deal liberalism. And that's a new idea that had never existed until FDR stumbles into creating it. And that has been the motivating idea for the Democratic Party ever since. And Joe Biden runs on the same set of ideological ideas. So when realignment changes that, where you have not just a new coalition, a new ideological base for the party.
You know, what's so fascinating about this, which is, I love the way you've constructed this, because it helps sort through good faith and bad faith critiques of people, in the sense that mm-hmm. a talking point that you actually see, especially given the direction that Trump and especially Trump intellectuals tried to push the Republican Party in terms of we're the party of the working class, a talking mm-hmm. point you'll hear is, and this isn't to defend Joe Biden, it's just to articulate the point you're making, which is,
right,
well, actually, the very upper middle class people who hated FDR, the very rich people who hate FDR, now vote for Joe Biden. And those working class, coal mining, metal pail lunchbox people, they now vote for Trump. What happened to FDR's Democratic Party? The point is, within your framework, the set of voters could entirely switch. But all that really matters from a framework perspective is which party is articulating the viewpoint that the FDR coalition cemented. And the point is, as long as, you know, frankly, the Biden presidency is advancing hefty stimulus packages and whatever Republican presidency isn't, it doesn't really matter who's voting who.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing with the solid South and the Northeast, right? People like to focus on, so if you go to 1932, the Northeast is the bastion of the Republican Party, and the South, the solid South, is the bastion of the Democratic Party. All right, and now it's completely reversed. And people say, well, there must have been some kind of realignment because the people changed. But one, the people didn't change, right? The people who were voting, the Northeastern Republicans who voted for Hoover, they didn't change. Their kids voted differently than they did. So the first part is it wasn't even a real change, right? It was mostly a generational shift. And beyond that, it's why? Because the next generation, even though they lived in the same area, they had different values and beliefs for different reasons. You know, history changed, so the voters who were attracted to those ideas changed. So the ideas stay the same, the parties stay the same, but which parts of the country are attracted to those ideas change. Well, it's not the parties that changed. It's the demographics of America changed. So the voting, which states vote for who, changes, but it doesn't mean that the parties are any different.
Let's talk about your idea of these eras as being shaped by big debates, because I want to know how much you think the outcome of these debates are inevitable or were sort of decided before the game even began. So a good example of this is immigration. So 1965, Lyndon Johnson's Congress passes the Immigration Act, and you see America permanently change in a very specific way. A immigration system which preferenced Western Europeans shifts to a much more global perspective in a way that oftentimes was not fully understood by even the people who were supporting the legislation. And you see the demographics of America just entirely change, irrespective of debates about undocumented immigrants, complete sea change of the country, much more of a preference towards East Asians, South Asians, all these huge myriad debates. So throughout the course of this fifth party system, one of the most polarizing issues we've had is the debate over immigration. Amnesty, restrictionism, H-1B visas. We could give all these different examples. Some are economic, some are tied to like really like evil race stuff. Some are tied to basic debates about culture, which are entirely reasonable to have. But to a certain degree, if the debate is the country going to be the country of the 1950s, or is it going to be a country that looks very different? The second that legislation was passed, effectively, it was over. So I'm curious how you just think about how debates operate like this, right? In the sense of how often are debates going to conclude inevitably, and how often are they not going to go that way?
I kind of see it a little differently, only because I don't think anybody ever wins a debate. I always think it's a synthesis. So when I look at each of these debates, so it's a push and pull, right? One side comes up with one set of ideas. The other side comes up with a contrary set of ideas. And ultimately, America resolves to take some from both. And that's when it gets resolved. No side ever 100% wins. What happens is the overreaches of each side get ironed down, and the good points of each get adopted, and then the debate dies. So to do that, like, okay, let's just look. We keep talking about going through the system. So let's just go over all the debates, right?
Yeah.
All right. So the first party system is Federalists and Democratic Republicans. It's Hamilton and Jefferson. So what is that about? That is a debate about how do we translate this document, this set of documents, this republic that we wrote on paper. What does that mean in practice? And we have two different sets of ideas about what it's going to mean. You've got the sort of the Federalist, which is sort of a meritocratic republic, right? They have the Democratic Republicans would call them closet aristocrats, but that's not really right. They have a sense that a republic, this is this whole Republican virtue idea, that a republic really needs leaders, and it needs people of certain character, and that they need to inculcate sort of to replace what they had in Europe, right? Europe has nobles who were bred from birth to rule, and we've never had a republic. So how would you run a republic? And the Federalists think, well, we have to somehow create what they have without nobles, and this meritocratic sort of create a meritocratic class.
Urban-centric, very much like tied to that, yeah.
Yeah, this is the sort of Hamiltonian perspective. So that a republic we're going to have this meritocratic commercial republic. Versus the Democratic Republicans and Jefferson, who are looking at France and the French Revolution, and they have much more of a sort of a small government. They think a republic is based in the sort of small landholders and private farmers, and this is this debate about, all right, no one's ever made a modern republic. What is it going to be? How do we translate this into practice? And the answer that we came up with was some of both. Right, Jefferson won the politics. The Federalist Party died, and not only did it die, Jefferson, when he was president, the Federalists were already weak by 1808. But yet, you look at the policies, he basically adopted Hamilton's banking plan and most of Hamilton's policies. So
America, there's this great quote that I just want to bring it up because I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
There's this great quote where you brought up in the book, which is that Jefferson's people went to like the industrial plan that Hamilton had pursued, and they were ready to throw it out because they thought, but it's philosophically, right? If they are these yeoman farmers, Jeffersonian Republicans, like obviously they're like, look, this is going to be corrupt. It's going to be terrible. But they, in very flowery 19th century language, obviously say there is not but one thing not great here. Let's keep it, right? So that was just a fascinating
I think I think this was his Treasury Secretary, Gallatin, who was like, it's the most perfect system ever conceived or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And Jefferson got really mad about it because of the politics of it. But yeah, and he ended up, and it wasn't just that. It was even in foreign policy, and basically in every way, he adopted all the Federalist best ideas.
Yeah, expands the military, sends the first overseas adventure. And when in many ways that was the opposite. That's perfect.
So it's a synthesis still, right? So, you get democratic republicanism under Federalist, or federalism under democratic republican dressing. And neither side really won. They both won. We kind of did both. All right. So then the second party system, this is Jackson, right? So you get Jackson versus the Whigs. And this is a fight about what is it? I would say it's basically a great debate over the frontier, because what's changed now? So now we're the Federalist Democratic Republican debate is resolved. We've basically, America has answered what kind of republic it's going to be. And now we've expanded all the way across the Mississippi River. And we don't just have a bunch of little cities on the coast. And we have all these small farms, and people are like, okay, well, we have all this flowering language. How are we going to bring the people into government? We have these two different ideas. You have sort of the Whig idea of sort of sanctity of labor and you know, we're going to build infrastructure and whatever, we're going to expand. But, you know, they're really trying to build up where the Democrats are trying to build out, right? The Democrats really want to expand out where the Whigs want to build up into cities. And they both want to find a way to bring people into government. But, you know, the Jacksonians are much more sort of rowdy about it, where the Whigs are much more sort of professional class about it. But regardless, you know, we ended up doing both, right? We ended up taking some of the Whig ideas. We bid all the infrastructure plans. All, you know, the Whigs got basically all of their policy ideas of Henry Clay. He had this American system, which was sort of the heart of their system, which was that we were going to build, you know, roads and canals and whatever to spread out west, which the Jacksonians thought was just boondoggles and wastes and money for bankers. But we ended up doing all of it. But we also did all the democratizing ideas that the Jacksonians wanted to do. We spread out west. We created more land for settlers. We ended voting restrictions. So we ended up, again, doing both. And then when we did both, the party died. Yeah.
Well, quick thing, because I'm getting a slightly positive picture, but in the book, you specifically say the story of this second party system, however, is that this is how realignments can go wrong. So what goes wrong in the picture you're describing?
All right. So what goes wrong is once we resolve it, right? So by the 1840s, this debate is in practice dead, right? We have Andrew Jackson is still, you know, he's gone and off the scene, and we have this, the Jacksonian ideas, you know, he was fighting against the bank. We'd resolve the bank war stuff. There's really nothing to fight about in politics. So things start to stagnate. And then we have this new problem, which is what to do about the as we expanded west, it was really about the Mexican-American War and the expansion west. And what are we going to do about slavery? Because all of a sudden in the Mexican-American War under Polk, we took land for, I forget how many states it was. It was something like 10 new states. And so now all of a sudden at the top of the agenda is, well, are they going to be slave or free? And the South obviously didn't want any more free states because they knew that if there were more free states, they were going to lose the Senate and that slavery would be abolished. So this issue that everybody wanted to push off was all of a sudden couldn't be pushed off because now we have 10 new states we have to admit, we have to decide today. And at the same time, there's the religious revival, the abolition movement and all this. We had a religious revival at the same time where all of a sudden, you know, America throws itself back into religion and their big issue is slavery is a moral evil. So when you had before this period where Americans were willing to sort of push off this debate because they didn't want to rip the country apart, now the new generation, and you can see them sort of like the 1960s, it's like, no, these are evils that have to be solved today. This cannot be delayed. And we're not willing to compromise. There's no compromise to be had. This is good and evil. So you see those two changes. So that's now the biggest issue that has to get resolved. And the political parties see it as a distraction. They see it as a big distraction from the real issues, which are the Jackson issues that nobody cares about anymore. And so they keep trying to push it off and compromise, and the compromise of 1850 and all those terrible compromises. And it rips it really rips both parties down. It rips the Whig party apart in 1852 because they're divided over the issue and they hate each other. Now Northern and Southern Whigs hate each other. And 2 years later, the Democrats get pushed out of Congress and the know-nothings take over and we have a decade of political chaos. And the mistake that happened was the parties wanted to preserve the status quo of the dead issues when there was a new pressing crisis that they refused to acknowledge and tried to press off as a distraction.
With band-aids. With very quickly distinct. Actually, no, that's not even the right metaphor because they were not just they're basically band-aids dipped in acid because the actual band-aids made everything worse. So the compromise of 1850 actually made the crisis worse because it basically said, wait, this is all this is now arbitrary. You can't think the deals are going to be there. It's just, wow, that's useful too.
Well, and then, you know, right after it is, and then the Kansas-Nebraska Act where right after they do the compromise, you know, Stephen Douglas stupidly, because he wants a railroad going through Chicago, reopens the question of the Missouri Compromise to try to get Kansas and Nebraska, which is already slated to be free states. He wants to make them, you know, have this popular sovereignty, this idea that they'd have a vote, the settlers would have a vote. So now everyone's furious because now nobody trusts anybody. All these compromises don't even mean anything anymore because we're breaking them 2 years later. And then the real big problem is then all the settlers, because now it was a very stupid idea, popular sovereignty, because naturally political activists all moved to the state to stack the vote. So now you started having with guns, and then you got a basically bloody Kansas in a low grade civil war, which then helped rip the Democrats apart too. So yeah, it was just a series of disasters all built around treating what was the new debate that needed to be resolved as a distraction and trying to double down on a party system that was, for all intents and purposes, dead, because it was about issues that didn't matter. And that's why the Whig Party and the Democrats, and you know, the Democrats got, they survived it, but they got really hammered. The Whig Party collapsed, and we had really a decade of utter chaos. You know, that was with the Know-Nothing Party coming in, and you know, three parties for a while, and a lot, all kinds of political violence, because once the system fell apart, then it would only have to be put back together by, you know, by blood and tears. And that's the worst. That was the worst realignment, and it's the one to avoid.
Yeah. So basically, we can skip the Civil War because that one's self-evident how that ended, basically. But so that takes us into the third party system. What was the third party system? Who were the figures, and how did it resolve itself?
Yeah. Well, the third party system is what came out of the Civil War. It was now a new Republican Party that represented the North, and a Democratic Party that represented the South. And it really, the great debate was Reconstruction. It was the aftermath of the war.
Actually, it's not even that they represented the South. In many ways, they represented the quote-unquote like losers, right? Mm-hmm. So the people, and this is what leads us into our earlier conversation about William Jennings Bryan. It's Midwesterners who've been left behind. The frontier has closed, so expansion is no longer just an option. If you fail in Kentucky, mm-hmm. you just can't keep moving. If it's the 1820s, if you fail in Kentucky, just go west.
Go west.
But eventually it closes. That's the whole Frederick Jackson Turner thing.
Or the immigrant political machines is actually the other. That's the other really great part of the Democratic Party of that era, is all the Irish machines like Tammany Hall in New York, right? And, you know, New York is controlled by the Republican Party. So if you're an Irish immigrant and you want political influence, you're going to be a Democrat. So all those political machines, the urban political machines that got set up in the North that under the banner of the Democratic Party, it's because they were the ones locked out of the system. The system was controlled by the Republicans. So if they wanted to push back and get control of the system, they did it as Democrats. So that, and then you had this bizarre alliance, right, between Tammany Hall and the Irish immigrants and all, you know, in all the cities, you had the urban immigrant political machines and then the South, and they hated each other. But they had a common interest, so they worked together.
You say it that way, and it's quite obvious why this political coalition did not win many presidential elections, when you put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the worst part of that party system, and this is what we're talking about again, the Gilded Age, because it's really vibrant for a short period of time until we get to the end of Reconstruction. But once Reconstruction ends, and basically both of the parties realized, I mean, there was a number of reasons about why that happened. There was an economic downturn, you know, there was the horrible Tilden election and everything. And but the biggest thing was America got tired. They'd been fighting this thing since the Civil War. It had been 15 years of bloodshed and then trying to occupy the South, and they just gave up. And that created the Gilded Age, where really after that point, nothing was happening. So you had two parties.
The ultimate example of nothing is happening in politics is like the big debate was civil service reform, which is just inconceivable by our point in terms of our time of what would be the big. I'm not saying it mattered, right? I'm not saying it wasn't an important issue. It actually resolved like an important depending on your politics.
It was a response to that corruption because politics died, right? Politics basically ends for a while at Reconstruction. Practical problem. Nothing's happened. You know, there's still politics. There's still elections. There's still people holding offices. But there's really nothing on the table, because what's on the table, everybody knows isn't going to happen. So we run elections on run Robinism and rebellion. And the only thing that's happening is corruption, and all the railroad companies are buying off politicians, and politicians are pure careerists. And the corruption got so bad, which is why civil service reform is the only thing people are talking about. And it cuts across the parties. It's not even really partisan. It's the politics is so decayed that there's a faction of good government people who want to do something about all the corruption, and then everybody else who's just riding the, using the government like a gravy train.
Yeah. So that we covered the, you know, the
Brian.
Yeah, we covered Brian. So what's
well, and that's it, but what's yeah. the debate? And what's important about the debate is, right, economic transformation, industrialization, right? Like, what yeah. do we do about the middle class getting left behind? And, you know, all the immigrants now, again, immigration is another big deal because the cities are exploding with opportunities and factories. And what are we going to do about, you know, the conditions in some of these factories where you get stuff like child labor and all the progressive issues to deal with all the abuses in early industrialization? And, you know, you had an America that was built around agricultural issues. And the biggest issue now is adjusting to a new economy, then the New Deal.
So then where does that leave us? Because the key thing is that, and this is the part which is taking it to the earlier part of your conversation, we did this in a semi-interesting yeah. order, which is basically that these, in the 50s, everything we're discussing is really summed up under the realignment theory. And I'm noticing as we're talking about the timeline between these different realignments, it's actually much shorter than the period from the New mm-hmm. Deal to today. So why is that? Because there's obviously no iron law of history or science or Hegelian thought that says realignment shall last 30 years. But why has this period lasted so long? Let me put it a better way. Yeah, so why has this period lasted so long? And why haven't big events, which conceivably could have spurred changes, not made, had the effect? So for example, the Cold War ending, September 11th, the 2008 financial crisis, many people saw that as a reset opportunity, didn't happen. What was going on at a meta level during this realignment period? Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. So this is, all right, so let's just start. So you start sort of foundationally. So what is liberalism and conservatism? All right. So politics, liberalism and conservatism come out of the New Deal, right? So before this, we have populism and progressivism. The Republican Party is the progressive party of Teddy Roosevelt, married to the Yankee Calvin Coolidge people, which is an ideology that's both liberal and conservative in a weird way compared to today. It doesn't really match up. And then you get Bryan's populist Democratic Party, which eventually adopts sort of the Wilsonian fake progressive. There's a whole debate there about whether Wilson's really a progressive, but Wilson kind of grafts onto it. All right, so that's this debate. And it has nothing to do, and it doesn't graft with liberalism and conservatism that we now have, right? Mm-hmm. Those ideologies happen under FDR. So FDR is faced with the Great Depression. The Republican Party under Hoover gets demolished, and the Republicans get thrown out of office. FDR becomes the president, and he has to solve the crisis. And he gets this brain trust. He gets all the smartest people he can find to do whatever they can do to solve the problem. And he doesn't pull from partisans. He pulls a lot of Republicans and a lot of Republican progressives. And they start innovating, and they create the first New Deal is in two stages. The first New Deal is this progressive program. It's just like old progressivism is trying to use social science and expertise to plan the economy to fix the Depression. And then there's a backlash to it with Huey Long and Father Coughlin and all this. And then from populist Democrats, traditional populist Democrats, at which point you get the second New Deal, where then they add to it all the stuff like the Works Progress Administration and all the social spending to sort of directly put money in the hands of workers. So now you have two ideas, populism and progressivism, that had been split across the parties, are combined, and it becomes this new philosophy, liberalism, New Deal liberalism, or what we now call liberalism. So that's where that is. And then the response to that is conservatism. Why? So people fighting about the New Deal, they have two main objections. The first is this idea that it's an attack on liberty. It's big government. It's government that's taking on too much power. And you get stuff like the Liberty League. And a lot of these people, of course, are Democrats, right? They were with Roosevelt. They were Democrats. Guys like Al Smith and guy who's former head of the DNC. You get a lot of big Democrats with this too, that it's an attack on liberty, or also it's un-American, that it's somehow undercutting the culture that led to American success and that the democracy needs to survive, liberty and virtue, which then under Buckley gets combined formally into a new ideology, conservatism, right? It starts under FDR as sort of an ad hoc set of criticisms, and these critics, who a lot of times don't even like each other, but they're now working together on the same team, and they get forged ultimately into one united ideological group. And Buckley and his team at the National Review turn it into a coherent ideology, conservatism. And that's where that comes from. So we invent these two ideologies, liberalism and conservatism. All right, what is that fight actually? It's a fight about how to manage an industrial economy, right? It's about, okay, we have a 20th century industrial economy. We have factories and cars and sort of the modern post-World War II world, well, originally the war and the post-war world. How do we manage that properly? And one set of solutions is New Deal liberalism, because New Deal liberalism came up as a solution to, okay, the Republic had been discredited by the Depression. A lot of people lost faith in America. They thought we needed to maybe reform it, maybe throw it out, do something like a modern government, by which they meant communism or fascism, which people at that time perceived as more successful and more modern. They thought democracy might be an outdated ideology that didn't fit modern industrial life. And so we have this crisis, and the solution FDR comes up with is liberalism. And then conservatism says, hey, okay, we can reform our institutions to deal with modernity, but let's take into account this liberty and virtue, and not, we can't go too far, we need to put limits on it. And this is the debate that we're having. All right. So why does it last as long as it does? Because that debate is relevant as long as it is. As long as we have an industrial economy and we're fighting over what is the proper way to regulate it, it's a relevant debate. It also took that long to resolve, because the Democrats basically ran the system until at least the 70s, when this conservative movement started pushing back, and then ultimately under Reagan got their turn to put in their reforms. So that story of how that played out, you know, the Democrats put their ideas in through the original New Deal, eventually expanding it into social issues with the Great Society. And then the Republicans, they start pushing back and they start saying, okay, well, where are the limits? Where do we reform it? And that starts in the 70s and then under Reagan, and then sort of the conservative pushback through the 90s. And then in the 90s, what happens? Well, under the Gingrich-Clinton fight, both ideas come to their endpoint, because the Democrats realize, well, this is as far as the New Deal liberalism is going to go. We are not going to, there will be no new great society. It's done. We've gone as far. We don't want to lose what we've done, but we're not going to go any farther. This is the limits of our ideas. They basically are now out of ideas. They have nothing else to do. Healthcare is the one thing that they keep talking about that they still would like to do. And the conservatives have also reached the end of their ideas, because they've unwound from Reagan through the 90s parts of the New Deal that they didn't like. We're going to reform welfare as we know it. We're going to put cost-benefit analysis.
Because the key thing here is that the part which pushes us towards Democrats is that Republicans, as an electoral necessity, accept the broad constructs of the New Deal. So you're not running against the existence of Medicare and Medicaid. You're not running to overturn Social Security. That's their limit there.
Yeah, and then by the 90s, you saw that under the Gingrich Congress, where, you know, people is still trying to float, we're going to privatize Social Security, and it becomes obvious we're not undoing Medicare, we're not undoing Social Security. We've done the limits of our ideas. And the American people, why did they reach the limits? The American people were basically happy with the consensus, right? They were like, okay, we like Social Security and Medicare and these programs. We're okay with these new agencies. We don't want to undo them, but we like the conservative limits that they put on them. We like all of these other things that need to be taken into account. We don't think that they should just be unlimited.
I'm just smiling real quick because when you're talking about agencies, there's no actual constituency for abolishing the Department of Education. There's obviously a conservative argument for why that's an overreach, but that's not actually something which is going to drive an actual policy outcome.
And every time that they talk about it, they end up having to backtrack on it, because the American people are like, what? You don't like education, and that's the end of it. Because, and then the biggest problem too, so you had all that in the 90s, where the ideas, we've reached the end of the ideas, and now the economy changed. So it's not even relevant anymore. So the whole fight that we started under FDR, not only have we basically reached a national consensus, we also now have a post-industrial global modern world with all kinds of new problems that have nothing to do with an industrial economy, and to which the party's toolkits don't have anything to respond to. Because if you try to come up with, okay, what do we do with the rise of AI or the rise of China? All right, is the answer more New Deal programs? It doesn't make any sense. Is the answer fight big government? It doesn't make any sense. The two parties have toolkits that are built to dealing with industrial problems that don't have tools for the problems we now have. And that ultimately has led to stagnation, because we have two coalitions built around ideologies meant to solve problems that no longer exist. And we have new problems that need solutions that they don't have tools. And if they try to create tools, it means breaking orthodoxy. It means alienating their coalition. It means doing something brand new. And they haven't chosen to do it. So they don't have any tools to solve the problem. And all these problems, as they start racking up, people want answers. What are we going to, you know, people's lives are being affected. They want answers. What are you going to do about this stuff? And both parties basically have sort of orthodoxy that it's a non sequitur to the problems we have. So why did it take that long? It took that long both for the industrial era to end and for a new debate to start. It took us that long to resolve the debate in the first time. And there's no magic to how long it takes. It just took us longer because of the way the world changed, the rate at which the world changed. And then, there's this other issue of what happened in the we were talking about the 60s, where, so everybody thought there was going to be a realignment in around the 60s to the 80s, because it had been about the right amount of time based on the past. And clearly something big was going on. And then everybody was gearing up for it. And they thought that all of this social disruption that was happening was the heart of what would be a realignment. And then the realignment didn't happen because the Democrats ideologically just added new issues. The Republicans added new issues. We took what had been economic liberalism and we extended it into social problems of social liberalism of the Great Society. We took economic conservatism. We're going to fight economic big government like taxes and regulation. Now we're going to fight social big government like the Great Society. Mm-hmm. So the ideologies didn't change, and then everybody got frustrated with why it didn't happen.
To make this clear for everyone, because an earlier example is really useful, was the point about the Second Bank of the United States after Jackson. So Jackson ends it, the issue dies in the 1840s. But this is the situation we're in now is as if a new situation in 1842 brought back up the debate again. Is that the correct way of understanding what you're saying? What I'm saying is that the reason why it's going on is that, so let me put it a better way. The reason, if I'm correct, the reason why the realignment doesn't happen is that the issues or the debates that you were describing reapply themselves in new contexts? Is that it?
Yeah, I guess that's sort of, or don't. See, the big thing to me about the mid-20th century social change is that the economic issues didn't go away, right? It's not like the taxes and regulation part of the New Deal fight went away or had become irrelevant. So the parties grafted new issues onto themselves that were still attractive to their existing coalitions. But the original issues were still there and relevant and live issues that we were still fighting about in politics. So to create a new party system, we would have had to have thrown away the New Deal debate, the fight from the 30s about taxes and regulations and regulatory agencies and big government. That would have had to have gone away, but it didn't. We just expanded it into new issues without getting rid of the old ones. So
can I just put on my super liberal hat real quick? Just something I'm just realizing. Is it possible that the reason why this realignment has just taken so long is just the issue of race? In the sense that how much of the backlash against the Great Society is really about like racial issues? And there's a world where for America, where Sweden, for example, we would have just accepted policy merits aside, the ideals. So for example, if there's no racialized welfare queen discourse, not effectively settled the debate over how involved in the economy the government is?
Yeah. I think probably that's It's hard
right,
to
it's
know.
It's interesting,
it's
right?
fascinating. Because, yeah. Well, I've thought about it a little too, because particularly when you start talking about what, you know, Nixon was up to in the 70s when he did his law and order campaigns. Like, he was very, it was both an natural extension of Republican ideology into social issues, right? Where the Republican Party, opposes big government. The Democrats are now doing big government in social things. So naturally, it's not really a change what Nixon did to oppose social big government, because ideologically, of course, the Republican Party wouldn't like social big government. It's still big government, which was the core of the party. Mm-hmm. And yet, Nixon was very aware while he was doing this of the racial implications of the rhetoric that he was employing. And you can read, you know, read Pat Buchanan, who was part of that campaign, and or Kevin Phillips or whatever. They were aware of that as well. So it's one of these things that points both ways, right? Where if that issue didn't exist, maybe it would have played out, you know, maybe we could have wrapped up the fifth party system a little faster. Maybe we would have, and maybe we could have gotten into the next one. Because to me, the fascinating part is not even just why did it take so long, is that, you know, I think we've been done with the New Deal debate since at least the 90s. So it's also taken us a long time, you know, why didn't we march, you know, why didn't Obama march into the next party system? He could have, you know, people were so, he had a mandate to do whatever he wanted. His rhetoric seemed to acknowledge that people wanted some, not just normal change, but like that there were new problems that needed
something transcendent.
Right. And yet he governed as a New Deal Democrat. Well, why did he do that? Right. Like he did that. And then Trump comes in. And then, you know, with Trump, you could say, well, he starts building a new coalition, but then he doesn't build anything new, right?
He governs within the traditional Republican. Larry Kudlow is his economic policy person.
Yeah, I've always said he's basically James Buchanan, because if you look at like James Buchanan,
so not Andrew Jackson.
No, I think he's James Buchanan, because James Buchanan is a guy who. So this is in the years before leading. He's the last president before the Civil War. He can see that the system is starting to fray. He sees the political opportunities. You could say the same of Franklin Pierce, his predecessor, too. They see the political opportunities on these new issues, but they're not willing to throw out the old orthodoxy and actually do anything about them. So they use the political energy to help rip things down without building anything. And I've always thought Trump is a very similar type of figure, where he was savvy to see the old system, you know, when he starts tapping into the populism and all these different sort of just rhetorically, he taps into it to win votes, but he doesn't actually do anything transformational in what he actually governs with. So he doesn't build a new party with it, and he just uses this force to help tear things down a little faster without actually doing the rebuilding of the next party system, you know?
What's fascinating about that is I brought up Andrew Jackson for a reason, because Steve Bannon, when he came into the White House, was very clear about wanting Trump to be a Jacksonian figure, in the sense that if the Trumpian Bannonite project was successful, it would be the Andrew Jackson metaphor would be perfect. There would be these big, it would be a realignment. There would be these big issues. There was, you know, you could in many ways argue like the post-World War II international order, NAFTA, all these things that Trump ran against could have been the equivalent of the Great Bank, the Second Bank of the United States. But I think the clear implication of what you're saying is that the failed version of Trump equals the successful version of Trump is Jackson. The right. Failed version of Trump, the Trump that does not win re-election, is Buchanan.
Exactly. And that's ultimately, you know, that's his personality. He's not a policy wonk. He's not really interested
in that. But neither was Jackson. But this is the thing which is interesting, right?
Yeah.
So I guess there's a deeper. My point there is that the cleavage.
But Jackson had Van Buren. That was the difference, right? Jackson had Van Buren, who was to help him. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. But no, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, FDR wasn't either, and that's, you know, one of the things I find fascinating about FDR is he also wasn't a policy guy. He just knew it was important and put policy people in charge.
And this takes us to the current moment. Two last questions here. So one. What do you think of Joe Biden in all of this context? Because the thing that interests me about Joe Biden, and this could be drinking too much like DC area Kool-Aid or just exhaustion with the Trump era, but I just genuinely think there is something, at least so far, to the Joe Biden as LBJ or the Joe Biden as FDR in several senses. So sense number one, like not geniuses. No one thought that FDR was like, a lot of his contemporaries would like remark about the fact that he wasn't the brightest bulb. You know, LBJ was not well-read, was not particularly, he was very bright in a, but in a different, in a very much, he was not coming from Harvard. He's not, you know, JFK quoting poetry and doing all the great stuff. Street smart, exactly. But from a political perspective, FDR and LBJ are much more politically successful than their obviously successful predecessors, obviously more intellectual predecessors, Wilson, for example, and JFK, or Hoover, exactly. Yeah, Hoover's got the-
Hoover's brilliant. He's brilliance probably the most
plus hyper-competence. Most impressive, man, lots of second placers during this conversation. Yeah. But so what do you just think? I know, and then when we put this way then too, which is that it just seems to me, I mean, the approval ratings you're getting out of Biden right now are incredible. And obviously the Obama defender part of my personality could say, well, look, like Biden is governing without the race issue. Like there's no like Obama phones controversy. Yeah. There's no birth. There's no, you know, birth certificate controversy. Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I still think there's something to the idea that despite Joe Biden's lack of like intellectual impressing everyone at the like salon or something, he has a political talent that these really transformational presidents had. So I'm just curious what you think about all that.
I think it's up for grabs. So, and this is what I've been thinking. I thought this watching the whole Democratic primaries. And so the chance to be FDR or Teddy Roosevelt or William Jennings Bryan is clearly up for grabs. And it's not up for grabs for most presidencies. You know, most times
Carter doesn't have it.
the stars have to be aligned where the old system has decayed enough and there's new issues and an opportunity to be that transformational figure. You know, you can't be a transformational figure when the existing political system is working fine and solving people's problems adequately, because you're not going to build a 50% new coalition around new ideas when you can't get 50% of the people who are unhappy with the old system. So, Joe Biden has the opportunity to, and that's why I was actually looking a lot. You know, I kept watching Pete because thinking he could be a Brian, right? Because he's this young, come in, throw out all, he kept talking about how he wanted to throw out all the old orthodoxy. And then you look at Biden and he ran like FDR in that he ran on sort of restoring stability in the old order. But then like FDR had the choice to throw it out. Because, you know, the fascinating thing about FDR to me is he didn't run on the New Deal. Mm-hmm. He ran on old Democratic Party ideas of the former system. He attacked Hoover for his deficits. His big campaign issue was Hoover was spending too much, which, you know, that was a traditional Democratic attack. And then turned around and when given the wheel, threw out everything throughout the orthodoxy and did something new. And I think Biden could do that. The question is, will he? And that's why I've looked at him saying, yeah, he could. He absolutely could. The question does he have the will and the desire to do it? But to do it, he would have to throw out the old issues and look ahead to not just restoring stability of the system that's dead, right? You know, if all we're going to do is put this decision off a couple years to shore up a system that no longer solves people's problems, then we're going to be back here in 2-4 years anyway, right? If the result of a Biden presidency is that we just keep the fifth party system debate going on even farther, then the same opportunity will exist in the next election and somebody else is going to seize on it. But if he chose to, yeah, he could do it. And it's been fascinating to me because I think he might. I've been thinking he might, but he's in a tough spot because you have to alienate, just like FDR did. You have to alienate a lot of your key supporters and your staff and people who have built their career in the party, because it means anything you do that's innovative is going to bring in new people and throw and alienate old people. And that takes great courage to do. But yeah, he could. I think he has the opportunity. He might have the personality and the desire. And the opportunity, I think, yeah, it definitely exists. It's just a question of will he do it.
I think the thing, I'll make a particularly not brave prediction. And yeah. I see Biden as being a necessary figure in the sense that, because like you said, there are really terrible realignments, there are yep. transitional realignments, and there are good realignments. I think Biden, once again, for all of our like right-wing listeners, this is me just hypothesizing in good faith. We have a very active comments section, as you could tell. So I know some people are getting hyperventilating right now. But the best case scenario for me for Biden is that Biden is the necessary transitional figure. We need to have a good realignment. So Biden is the figure that can calm American politics down from the breaking point that Trump was pushing it towards. I think that it's something that's always difficult for me is when people complain about wokeness and excesses of the left. Like it seems to me it's like, guys, this is obviously a result of Trump upping the ante. Because he's a figure who polarizes. And in that sense, if he's going to push the right to be right, the left will be left and that will be that. I think Biden has the opportunity to stabilize, hopefully during an economic post-COVID boom, to stabilize and then give both parties the opportunity to get their stuff together, which in many ways is his argument for the Mayor Pete wing of the party, which is where he's very explicitly saying, I'm the bridge to the next generation. Yeah. Yeah, please.
I'm gonna give you the dark side of that though, which please. Is the next. There is okay. Trump stumbled into being Trump, but he's tested the product now. There will be somebody in the next election who is savvier and more ruthless, who sees these opportunities and seizes upon them. And I don't know that we have the time to stabilize things. I truly don't. I'm concerned that the difference, we talk about good and bad realignments, and it really comes down to, does the leader of the party choose to throw out the orthodoxy and start fresh? Look at the problems fresh and say, let's do something that deals with the new problems ahead, and let's forget everything we thought we knew about what we believed in, what we cared about, because we have new problems and we need a new ideology to deal, not just ideology, we need a new approach. Okay. So if the leader does that, then we don't need to have the collapse because we get the realignment no realignment's easy. It's still a hard, people get angry, you get rough years of politics, but you get without the collapse. But if you wait too long and nobody does it, it'll happen on its own. And that's what the Whig collapse is about, where it'll happen because if the leaders don't do it, then external forces will force it. And then that's the hard way because that'll take years. It's much harder to rebuild something when there's a vacuum, when every crazy person with a bad idea starts jumping into the public stage and says, here, I want attention, I want power. And then you have to resolve it from the rubble. And that's what I'm worried about, is that if a leader doesn't come around and do it, then that's how it plays out. And the question is, how long do we have until events, I feel like the candle wick is getting a little low on how many more presidencies we can have before somebody either chooses to do it before it happens on its own. That's my concern.
That's
the bummer side that,
I think that's the perfect place to end. Frank, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. I look forward to doing this again soon. And hey, where can everyone find you? I'd love for you to promote the YouTube. I watch the YouTube channel to prep and everything, so I'd love for you to promote it real quick.
Yeah. So I've got a YouTube series where I go all these, a lot of political history and going through the sort of the story of realignments and how they work. It's Frank DiStefano at YouTube. On YouTube, just Frank DiStefano is the name of the channel. And the book is The Next Realignment, and all of it is laid out there too.
Great, thanks so much. Hope you all enjoyed the episode. As you can tell, I got really excited talking about random history and William Jennings Bryan and the way realignments actually work, ways that Sagar and I have been correct in approaching this issue, ways we need to rethink it. So we're going to bring Frank back. We could have honestly gone on for 3 hours, and there's just so much to talk about. So let us know what your questions are. Let us know if you get a hold of the book or the YouTube channel, what you'd like to focus with him on. We're really, really down to dive deep into this where we can. A lot of great issues like this. As always, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you all next time.